Countrywide on ABC Radio.
Support businesses are going to go to the wall just like dairy farmers will.
We've seen the whole agricultural community come out.
Once people leave communities, they generally don't return.
Countrywide.
Don't worry about me. Go and speak to your farmers.
We're already losing businesses.
Get out there and speak to your farmers today. With your gumboots on.
Countrywide, the politics of food and farming on ABC Radio.
And hello there, I'm Nikolai Bailharts. On Countrywide this week, it has been an idea for a very long time that Northern Australia could become the food bowl that feeds the nation. Well, now a $15 million study reckons it can be done.
It is the nation's most ambitious assessment of Northern Australian water and soil resources. It reflects the potential for nearly 400,000 hectares of crops.
But will it happen, or will it remain for the moment a pipe dream? More on that. We do start today, though, with the ongoing challenges caused by drought. And calls are growing louder for the federal government to seize hay that's been earmarked for export so that it can be given to drought-stricken farmers. But hay exporters say it would seriously damage an important agricultural industry and Australia's reputation abroad. Jess Davis explains.
With no end to the drought in sight, CEO of the Australian fodder industry, John McHugh, says hay supplies are close to running out.
There's always going to be some hay in the system, but in terms of what's available commercially, we're about as low now as you'd want to go.
It sparked a debate over whether the federal government should be able to seize hay earmarked for export and instead give it to drought-stricken farmers struggling to feed their stock.
We all understand the devastating effect of the drought, but to actually, you know, place, I suppose, an onus on an industry, a legitimate commercial industry, to actually be able to alleviate this problem is an oversimplification of the issue completely.
Over the last week, social media has been awash with posts like this one.
It should not be being exported. It should be sent to our farmers. Another example of our governments looking after other countries before our own.
But hay producer Luke Femlingham says seizing hay for export isn't the answer.
Certainly gaining a lot of momentum on social media. There's probably people frustrated that they hear stories, you know, there's so many thousand tonnes available and it's been exported to China and Japan, and then they're sort of jumping on the bandwagon quite quickly and making their own assumptions, which I think is unfair.
Around 10 to 15% of Australian fodder is exported each year, with most of that already tied up in contracts.
You're attacking the hand that feeds you. Exporters are letting hay go domestically as well. To rob from an industry, it might seem like short-term damage, but it's really going to hurt the industry long-term, I think.
John McHugh says a move to seize hay would damage an industry that has been built up over decades. He says breaking contracts would ruin Australia's reputation as a reliable supplier.
You cannot just turn export markets on and off. So if we were to turn our export fodder industry off at any time, it's gone.
And he says when the drought breaks, the domestic market will be flooded with excess hay.
If we use the 2017 figures, that's 1.2 million metric tonne extra fodder into the domestic market. Prices will go down even further, and we'll have fodder growers who are going to be in desperate situations.
But South Australian hay broker Alistair Turner says exporters should be releasing more hay into the domestic market.
The exporters don't seem to be interested in it. And obviously they have their overseas contracts and things they've got to fill. But if we could work together to redirect some of the supply and help short-term crisis, that would be an ideal situation.
He says seizing the hay would be a draconian measure.
They would have to declare a state of emergency before something could be forced there, but a forced move like that would have ramifications all the way around. It could be quite damaging, yes.
National Farmers Federation President Fiona Simpson says governments shouldn't interfere with the free market.
You know, what's going to happen when we eat that? We're still going to be in the same position that we're in now.
John McHugh agrees.
And I would argue at the moment if we were to confiscate every bale of hay that every exporter had in the country, it wouldn't go very far at the moment to feeding anything.
CEO of the Australian Fodder Industry Association, John McHugh, ending that story from Jess Davis. And the Federal Agriculture Minister, David Littleproud, says in a quote, "The federal government has no plan to force compulsory acquisition of hay." We're sticking on this topic of just how hard it is to find hay during dry times. A major hay broker says he's stopped providing hay to livestock farmers because he believes that sellers are now taking advantage of desperate buyers. Haylink has delivered 61,000 tonnes of hay so far this year, but owner Alistair Turner says the only hay he can source now is wildly overpriced. and he isn't prepared to pass that cost on to drought-stricken farmers because he believes they're at risk of going broke.
The maiden supplies have been exhausted for a while, except for exceptionally high-priced parcels of hay, which have tended to drift lower in quality to unacceptable low-quality standards at extremely high prices.
So in those recent weeks, Alistair, we have seen those prices really take a big jump up, and you've made the decision really to withdraw from the market, I guess, and not be buying and selling on or providing that hay at those prices.
Price gouging is rife at the moment. I won't supply fodder at prices I know is unsustainable for the customer. And the reality is that you cannot feed an animal fodder price that's above $400 a tonne and remain viable. And a lot of those prices are now up around $700. So somebody's going to get hurt. A supply chain has to work for all parties involved. And once it becomes unviable for one party, then the chain breaks. And once the chain's broken, then nobody's going anywhere.
But as we've talked about, clearly there is still hay moving. People are selling at those prices. People are buying at those prices.
Yes.
You really equate that to price gouging?
It is price gouging is what it is. And it's very, very disappointing. It's very hard to deal with when you see charities and media promoting the drought, which actually promotes the hysteria in the market. And people donating money to people to buy fodder at unsustainable prices. So one side of the coin is the charity and the government is donating money to the price gougers on the other side. Probably a statement that's not going to win me too many friends, but that's the reality. And I drew a line that I wouldn't go above, and I've stuck to that. And I've had to say to my customers, no, I can't supply you. Where it's more like I won't supply you at that price.
Some of those customers that you've been supplying hay to, and they've spent many thousands of dollars on hay, investing that in their stock, you are concerned about their viability going forward?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. That's why I will not supply hay at prices I know that is unsustainable for the customer, because if I do supply it and if they keep paying that price, then the potential for them to collapse is higher. And if they pay that price, well, then my customer is at extreme risk of not being there next year.
And what are they saying to you when you're saying that you're just withdrawing from the market when prices are so high?
Well, they say to me, well, what am I going to do? Who will I get it off? I said, well, I don't know who you'll get it off. There are people out there that possibly you can get it off at an enormous price. But I'm saying, well, now is the time to make another plan before you go over the cliff.
So the time has come for them to destock if they're in that position?
Well, partially destock or to think about it.
So you'll only get back into the hay market when the price does come down, and it appears that that will only happen when new season stock comes online. What are your hopes and expectations for that new season stock?
We've got good seasons in South Australia and parts of Victoria. We're desperately hoping for rain in the drought areas so they can get summer forage crops away, and hopefully that'll rein prices in. If we got large frosting events in cereal crops, then we'd get a larger amount of hay come onto the market. Like I'm bidding now on new season crops, and I'm not getting any takers because I'm bidding well under the market value that the suppliers think is the market value, which is pinned on the extreme high of the old season market. I've got back orders there for 1,000 semi-loads of hay now, but I'm waiting until I've got that supply at a sustainable price. You know, a bank doesn't write a loan to a customer that can't afford to repay it, so, you know, we've got a duty of care, really, to the whole rural economy to not supply fodder prices to people that can't afford it.
Hay broker Alistair Turner speaking there with Angus Furley. And you are listening to Countrywide on ABC Radio. My name's Nikolai Bale-Hartz. Well, there has been a fair bit of criticism about a lack of a national drought policy in Australia. So how about this for some ideas? Tax deductions to encourage farmers to take out things like crop and livestock insurance, or treating stored hay and fodder that's then used to feed starving stock as a tax loss. Well, there's some of the ideas that Richard Heath from the Australian Farm Institute thinks that the federal government should consider as it does start to form its national drought response. Mr Heath says while the pressure is growing on the federal government to respond to the crisis in the short term, so too are calls for a long-term drought policy to help farmers defy droughts in the future. He spoke with Marty McCarthy.
Because I think there's a realisation that droughts are not exceptional circumstances. Droughts are a frequent occurrence. They are a part of running a farm business in Australia. And unless that we have drought policy that accounts for that and enables farm businesses to prepare for frequent droughts, then the policy will otherwise be necessitating more and more frequent in-drought emergency measures, which will just become unsustainable.
So, Richard Heath, in your opinion, what's a practical measure that the federal government could implement to help move policy towards this idea of preparedness and helping farmers get ready for dry periods?
So there's a few different things that can be done to help with mitigating risk of drought. Mitigating the financial risk through insurance measures and looking at things like tax incentives for insurance premiums, for things like multi-peril crop insurance, are a really practical solution that can be looked at by governments for how they can create a market, a more sustainable and more affordable market for insurance products that help to mitigate the risk of drought.
Some state governments scrapped stamp duty on multi-peril crop insurance and there still wasn't a huge uptake. What could the federal government do to encourage farmers to look into that?
So things like, for instance, a 150% tax deduction for insurance premiums would deliver benefits, but obviously to the farmers for making those premiums affordable so they can take them out, but actually deliver benefits to government as well, because they obviously get tax on the income coming in from the insurance premium if it's paid out. But they also get the ability to take out those insurance policies mean that farmers are potentially going to be less risk averse knowing that they have those measures in place to mitigate risk, which means that they can adopt practices which lead to more output, which leads to more income and again more tax revenue for the government. So there is really positive benefits for everyone by potentially looking at measures like that.
One of the initial problems with multi-peril crop insurance is that there weren't actually that many insurance companies who even wanted to take it up because they didn't think there are enough farmers in Australia who would want it in the first place. So by providing incentives for farmers to take it up, would that work the other way by actually attracting more insurance companies to create products like that?
The more people you have taking out premiums, the more likely it is that you'll have new entrants into the market. You'll just have a bigger marketplace.
Another concern you've raised is that at the moment, hay and fodder that would normally, in a good year, a farmer could sell to make a profit on, at this point in time, it's just a loss for most farmers. What do you think can be done about that?
Farmers who store hay and grain for use during drought are foregoing the opportunity to sell that produce and receive cash flow for doing so. Farmers that, rather than storing that stuff to use, actually buy it during periods of drought, that is a cost to them that becomes a tax loss. And so, it's kind of perversely, potentially from a tax point of view, farmers, there's no incentive for them to store that hay or grain compared to buying it when there is a drought on. So measures that would look at how foregoing the income from storing hay and grain could also be treated in the same way as a tax loss, I think would really, be a positive measure for financially incentivising people to do that.
That would be, I imagine, a very difficult thing to ascertain, that value of that stored fodder.
Yes, and that's why, perhaps there is no proposal on the books yet, because it would be, difficult in the way that you'd monitor and manage that. But I think it's something that really does need to be looked at.
Richard Heath from the Australian Farm Institute, speaking with Marty McCarthy.
From the top end to Tassie, Countrywide on ABC Radio.
And my name is Nikolai Bailharts. Thanks for your company. Let's talk water now, and the Productivity Commission's raised a number of serious concerns about the progress of the Murray-Darling Basin Plan, which you'll remember was put in place, a national agreement to try and return water from irrigators to the environment to make sure that the river systems remain healthy. Well, a draft report into the plan's implementation is now warning a budget blowout could be looming unless basin governments quickly address a host of important issues. Clint Jasper has more.
The Murray-Darling Basin Plan's rollout gets a thumbs up from the Productivity Commission's Water Commissioner Jane Doolan in the following category.
Particularly in the area of water recovery. So we've found that about, at this point right now, about 20% of the water that over a decade ago was used for irrigation is now dedicated to the environment.
Earlier this year, the water recovery target was changed from 2,750 gigalitres down to 2,075 gigalitres, and around 2,000 of that has already been recovered.
So there is a small amount to go by June 2019. A number of it is contracted, and we tend to feel that meeting the target, which is the amended target after the Basin Plan amendments earlier this year, that governments have done reasonably well.
That's about where the good news ends, because by 2024, the plan's ultimate deadline, basin governments have agreed to deliver 605 gigalitres of water savings through an expensive set of projects known collectively as the supply measures. These include removing physical constraints along waterways, like low-lying bridges, improving the efficiency of environmental watering, and reducing evaporation from the Menindee Lakes in far west New South Wales.
So we do believe the next 5 years is very challenging. So governments have agreed, as you said, to invest in a package of complex supply projects. Those projects are interdependent, they're very ambitious. Planning has fallen behind already, and we believe that in some cases the timetable to deliver some of them is unrealistic.
The National Irrigators Council's Steve Wan agrees.
It is something that we've been talking about for some time. We have been urging governments to be out on the ground talking to communities about how to get the projects done, and we've emphasised from the moment we were started to support those 605 gigalitres worth of project that it was a tough task to actually achieve them in the timeframe.
In some cases, there's local opposition to the projects. Some require consultation with over 3,000 stakeholders, and the plan only has 5 years left. There's a risk some might not deliver the water savings they've promised, and if they're not done in time, then the government will be forced to acquire more water from irrigated agriculture to meet the water-saving obligations under the plan, which could cost taxpayers an additional $480 million.
So under the current basin settings, if those projects do not deliver by 2024 on their objective, then yes, water recovery has to be made good. Governments have to recover the water. Under the current policy settings, that's either by purchase up to the cap or by investment in further irrigation efficiency.
To avoid these pitfalls, the Productivity Commission has made a number of draft recommendations around extending the timelines to get these projects done properly, while also ensuring the governments don't try to skip out on their actual obligations to deliver water to the environment. And that's the type of conflict at the heart of its recommendation to split the Murray-Darling Basin Authority into two separate institutions. If you think about those supply projects, the MDBA is on one hand the government's expert advisor when it comes to the modelling for those projects and their rollout, but it's also the body responsible for ensuring the government sticks to all of its obligations under the plan.
Both of those roles are important, and both of them are becoming increasingly important over the next 5 years, and there is a conflict between those roles. We believe they need to be separated to give community the confidence they're both being undertaken to the maximum ability.
The split's a move the Australian Conservation Foundation's Dr. Paul Sinclair wholeheartedly agrees with.
Reading between the lines of this report, what it makes really clear is that there has been a failure of governance in the Murray-Darling Basin and a lack of transparency around the implementation of water recovery that needs to be fixed. So the Commission are recommending that the Basin Authority be broken into two because they're unable to deliver their advice role and their regulatory role at the same time. That's something that we've been deeply concerned at for a while.
The National Irrigators Council also says it's an idea worth discussing. The overall message from the report is if the next 5 years are going to deliver a full Murray-Darling Basin plan with everything it initially promised, then governments need to be more transparent and cut the bickering.
Clint Jasper with that report. And you can find more details up on the ABC Rural website. Just head to abc.net.au/rural. Well, now let's turn to that age-old idea of the promise of a northern food bowl to feed our nation. A report commissioned by the federal government has identified several dam sites and nearly 400,000 hectares across northern Australia that it says would be suited to irrigated agriculture. The CSIRO has spent the last 2 years and $15 million investigating water and soils in three key regions of the far north. Our reporter Matt Brand spoke with Deputy Prime Minister and the Minister for Infrastructure, Michael McCormack.
It is the nation's most ambitious assessment of northern Australian water and soil resources. It reflects the potential for nearly 400,000 hectares of crops such as cotton and sugarcane, and it could potentially generate more than 15,000 jobs and nearly $5.5 billion in annual economic activity throughout northern Australia. So this is a game changer. It's transformational. $5.3 billion annual economic activity, 387,000 hectares of additional crops. This is going to be an absolute game changer for the Northern Territory, for Western Australia, for Northern Queensland. A great report, and just so excited about the potential that it could yield.
A report that says there's water and land in Northern Australia, do you really think that will attract investment?
Absolutely. Look, the previous CSIRO research helped expand water use in the Gulf region. These new reports will let us take the next steps in enabling Australians to grow more food, establish new industries in manufacturing and indeed creating more jobs.
Do you think it will encourage the current government to invest real money into northern infrastructure for agriculture?
Well, absolutely. And we already are doing that through the Northern Australia Infrastructure Fund. I know we've got the BFRAG program. I know, as the Minister for Infrastructure and Transport and Regional Development, that $3.5 billion has been set aside in the last budget for roads of strategic importance. $1.5 billion, importantly, of those dollars are going to go specifically quarantined, dedicated to Northern Australia. So this report and the potential it could bring, it's just going to unlock so much potential.
There's been reports like this over the years. In 2010, the Northern Australia Land and Water Task Force said that Australia's north could only support around 60,000 hectares of agriculture. The report out today says it's more like 400,000 hectares. I kind of don't understand how two reports can come up with such completely different outcomes just 8 years apart.
Yeah, well, this is a much more comprehensive report. Expanding our north is going to enable us to feed more of Australia's growing population. There's a burgeoning middle class there. It could create, the report is saying, the economic analysts are saying that 2,500 jobs around Darwin boost that local economy of Darwin's by up to $1.5 billion. I mean, this is exciting stuff. And, you know, we as a government are really committed to Northern Australia. That's why we've got a minister dedicated to Northern Australia. He also does resources in Senator Matt Canavan. He's excited about this. I'm excited about this. This is a positive report, and I think we should look at it in a positive way.
CSIRO has made some dam proposals in this report, including dams at Mount Bennett on the Finniss River in the Northern Territory and on the Upper Adelaide River in the Territory. Who do you think would build those dams?
Well, we could have private investors. Government could invest as well. We've got a dams policy. We've got a National Water Infrastructure Development Fund. We are the government which wants to build dams, and we're getting on with that job. We've committed to Rookwood Weir in northern Queensland, northern central Queensland, to the tune of $176.1 million, which is not only going to drought-proof Rockhampton, but also make it, mitigate against floods. So, you know, dams and weirs, they're important pieces of nation-building infrastructure, and, get the right proposal, get the right backing between state and federal governments, and indeed looking for public-private partnerships.
Michael McCormack, the Minister for Infrastructure, Transport and Regional Development. And you are listening to Countrywide on ABC Radio. My name's Nikolai Bailharts. Well, the debate around unauthorised filming on farms is intensifying at the moment amid a rise in drones and the use of social media to expose alleged animal cruelty. Tougher penalties are amongst the options that are being considered by a parliamentary inquiry in New South Wales, but it's facing opposition from animal rights groups, and even some in the farming sector say they're cautious about such a move. Others, though, say urgent changes are needed to national privacy laws. Gavin Coote reports.
Ian Pollard says he has nothing to hide at his piggery in southern New South Wales.
You know, we're more than welcome to sort of have show people what we're doing, but not at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning.
In recent years, he's been the target of animal activists, with secretly recorded images of his pigs being put on the internet.
You know, we get angry activists ringing us and it's all anonymous and you never quite know who it is or where it's coming from and that type of thing. And they base their views on stuff that's been taken out of context.
Drones and other surveillance technology is making it easier for animal rights groups to share what's happening beyond the farm gate. But many in the agriculture sector are growing anxious about their privacy. A New South Wales parliamentary inquiry is looking at whether farmers have enough protections from unauthorised surveillance. The Shooters, Fishers and Farmers Party wants laws which would compel animal rights groups to share any footage of alleged cruelty with police, not the media. Some in the farming sector aren't convinced this is the right step. Egg Farmers of Australia boss John Dunn is worried such a law could further deepen the divide between farmers and animal liberationists.
It will have the potential to either inflame the problem or not discourage the activity whatsoever.
Someone get this on camera.
And it's these recordings exposing alleged cruelty on farms that animal rights groups and media organisations say could become impossible to gather under such laws. Sarah Wallerden from the Lobby Group for Commercial Broadcasters, Free TV, told the inquiry many exposés which have sparked changes in animal welfare laws would not have been possible without illegally obtained footage.
Our view is if this bill was in place during the time that there was the investigations around the greyhound industry or the live export industry, those things wouldn't have come to light.
While there are varying trespass laws across each state, privacy advocates are worried farmers are powerless when activists obtain footage through other means. David Vale is the chairman of the Australian Privacy Foundation.
Nowadays, the technology means that individuals can harass you very easily and you can't really respond to them. In the inquiry today, the discussion was about, in some areas, drones, whether they're snooping over a farmer's fence or whether they're flying around and looking into your bedroom. At the moment, you know, essentially there's very little you can do about it.
But it's not state criminal laws David Vale thinks needs attention. He says having a national privacy tort, allowing farmers to sue if their privacy's breached, would prevent situations from getting out of hand. He points to other similar countries like New Zealand, the United States and United Kingdom, which do have such a law.
The thing is, at the moment, the farmers don't have, like all of us, don't have the right to sue for people breaching their privacy, and you don't have a forum for discussing what's the proper interest sort of boundary line between just the right to be left alone going about your business and some public interest test.
Linda Stoner from Animal Liberation supports the idea of a national privacy tort. She thinks the work done by activists wouldn't be prohibited.
But I think that they need to be tested in court. I think that there are many areas that can't be properly dealt with in Parliament that need to be tested by the judiciary.
But she's firmly against any moves to tighten surveillance restrictions.
It just means more and more cloud over the public being able to be aware of what is happening in these places. There's already just too much, you know, too many walls around what's happening in these facilities, too few people policing them. And it's only the actions by animal rights activists that bring these things to light.
Animal Liberation Chief Executive Officer Linda Stoner ending Gavin Coote's report. And that's it for Countrywide this week. Thanks for your company. If you'd like to know more about any of the stories you've heard today, just Google ABC Countrywide. You'll be able to find all the details there. My name's Nikolai Bailhuts. I'll speak to you again next time.